Okay. So Maureen Dowd is in our studio, and her latest book is Notorious. This is a great, what I describe as pool read. It's not a beach read. It's a pool read. Think of it as a cool, fun drink in the sun. And when you draw your last sip of one serving, you may have another, or you may put it down and go for a swim. Satisfying either way. Is Dowd pricking a prickly Kevin Costner and mining Patti Smith about mortality? When people close to you die, you absorb what you most admire in them, she says. It's like they leave a little gift. There are reminders in this book that the best eyes in Hollywood belong or belonged to Al Pacino. And who knew that Ryan Murphy is such a perfectionist that he uses a ruler when he makes his bed to make sure the sheets are even? You want to make sure the line is straight, especially with the print. I like right angles, he says. My copy of Dowd's Notorious is dog-eared with scores of insights to notorious people at interesting moments in their lives. There's Greta Gerwig on the eve of the Barbie release. And in April of 2017, there's Elon Musk defending humanity against the evil of robots before he became the thing that people fear the most. Then Musk was a self-described voice of moderation, and Dowd called him the guardian of human welfare. Now, isn't that ironic? Welcome to the studio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, John.
Welcome to Chicago. Do you get into our city much?
I was here for the convention, and I love Chicago. Former researcher of mine is our Chicago bureau chief, Julie Bosman. Unfortunately, she's away with her kids on spring break, so I don't get to see her, but she's lovely.
And you said to us off the air you'd like to maybe just pop into the Billy Goat. Is that right?
I know. I've been wanting to go there forever.
That has been an iconic place for Chicago columnists and journalists.
Right.
You know, you would expect to see Mike Royko's ghost there right now. But since the Chicago Tribune is no longer across the street and upstairs, it's a condo, you'll see more tourists than you will see journalists.
I saw that during the convention. That was disorienting to see the Chicago Tribune was condos.
How do you remember the convention in Chicago?
Well, I'm always happy when I'm in Chicago. So when they pick a city that I love, it just makes it a lot more fun.
We were nervous about the police activity, disruptions.
Right. No, it was.
And just the very execution of a major convention the whole world was going to watch. I think our city did well.
Yeah, Julie, my friend, was covering that angle of it. And it seemed like everything went really smoothly.
The complaint from people like you was that they didn't get to see much of Chicago. You'd either be
right
in a hotel ballroom or out at the United
States. Right.
So there was no going to the Billy Goat or the architecture
exactly.
book tour or stuff like that.
Not enough drinking.
Well, I heard there was some of that. So when you put this book together, this collection of stars, as it says, from Hollywood culture, fashion, and tech, I presume you picked out the columns you wanted to rerun the most.
Yeah, some of them were, one of them was a Vanity Fair cover, one of them was a GQ cover. There are a few in there that were not in the New York Times. And then a few years ago, I used to have a column in the Times twice a week, and that's about 800 words. And I really, well, this applies to you too, because you are known as a great listener, and I really wanted to listen. And when you have a column, all you're doing is kind of proselytizing and telling people maybe what they should think, and that's not my happy place. My happy place is listening to other interesting people, and then I love to think of them as little impressionist oil portraits, and then you can give somebody, like, if you could spend 2 hours with Paul Newman, what would that be like? And although in that case I spent a week, but
what was that like?
It was, he had been, you know, my cinematic heartthrob since I was a teenager. I had a poster of him on the wall and the tight white t-shirt. And I really admired him as an actor. And I got to write about him for the cover of the New York Times Magazine when I first got to the New York Times. And it was like heavenly to get that assignment. But as I got to know him and the week wore on, I began to feel a little sad because he's, you know, he was, at that point, I think he was 60 about, and so he was cresting as a sex symbol. He'd been a sex symbol for 30 years, and he was really struggling with that. And in the book they did from his diaries, you can feel that struggle. You know, he wanted to get those roles, and Joshua Logan told him he didn't have any sexual threat, and he started working out and, you know, became like a sex symbol, and Joanne Woodward helped him. But it was a little bit of a Frankenstein story because it got so big. It overwhelmed both of them, I think, and just had such a huge influence on his life. Well, he's the opposite of, like, I recently interviewed George Clooney for 5 hours. And George Clooney wears that sex symbol thing so lightly. He jokes about it. And I read him our movie review of Wolves with Brad Pitt. And it was all about how great they looked. And I said, do you feel objectified? And he goes, no, I like being objectified. But Paul Newman did not.
Yeah, he was a little guarded, as was Robert Redford when you talked to him. Here is you talking to Paul Newman. You got him to say you have such an investment in the roles you play. You have to step back sometimes and figure out whether you're doing you or somebody else. Will the real Dustin Hoffman stand up? Where is Jack Nicholson? Where is Marlon? Could have been a contender Brando. I have no idea who these guys really are. Do you? He grins, you wrote. And then you said that would be, and then he said that would be a good title for your article. Will the real Paul Newman please stand up? And who is the real Paul Newman, you asked? And he said, none of your business.
Yeah, he, you know, his famous blue eyes were behind sunglasses.
He was wearing sunglasses for
and
that
he,
conversation.
When he first meets you, he leaves them on. And then the next day, maybe if he likes you, he'll take them off and hang them on his ear. And then at one point he lost them and I was helping him find them because they're his shield. And he said he really resented it when people would come up and say, take off your sunglasses. I want to see your blue eyes. And he would say, I would, madam, but my pants would fall down.
You mentioned the word objectification. Harvey Weinstein appears a couple of times in some of these narratives. Why wouldn't Uma Thurman and some of these other people? And it's hard to, at this day and age, not that it was that long ago, get your head around what a monster he was and how, to use your word, notorious he was and how long he was able to get away with it. Do you still marvel at that?
That was one of my hardest things. I wrote about Uma Thurman. She did have the encounter with Harvey Weinstein when she worked for him, of him demanding she come in the bathroom, and he was in his white bathrobe.
He wants to talk about the script and shows up in his bathrobe.
Right.
How cliche.
Right. But even with his power decimated at that point, at the point I wrote that, he was trying to save his career by going to an Arizona rehab center, and he was out there playing Scrabble. And his power was drained, but he still kind of roared back and tried to destroy the story through friends in the media, and he tried to put out, you know, a different narrative before my story appeared. And Uma was incredibly poised and in control.
And angry.
She was angry, but as far as dealing with Harvey, she said, I will handle this. And, you know, she was great to work with. But the weird thing about the Uma story is, yes, she had a bad Harvey experience, and the Times had broken all the Me Too stories, but her story was much, you know, different because she also had a beef with Quentin Tarantino. And Tarantino and Uma Thurman are one of the most famous auteur-actress relationships, like Alfred Hitchcock and Ingrid Bergman. And she, you know, at first she was saying she didn't know. She thought he had tried to kill her during the filming of Kill Bill. And he put
You're
her...
talking about Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah.
And the fact that he had to drive a car that she
car,
said was not safe.
That was not safe, and then he changed the route and gave all the stuntmen the day off. So even if she had wanted to get some help with the stunt, she couldn't. And there was a sharp curve on the route she didn't know about. And she did not want to drive the car. And he wanted, if any of you are Quentin Tarantino aficionados, he wanted the shot where she's looking in the rearview mirror and her hair's blowing and she's talking into the camera. And he just wanted her to do it. And he didn't want to give her all the facts about what the route would be.
She did. She crashed. She was injured. It was awful.
And it took her 15 years to get the footage out of him. Now, I think they are still in contact and everything. Her daughter was in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But she just wanted him to publicly acknowledge that he had put her in a dangerous situation. And he would not return my calls, even when she asked him. But then he gave an interview to Deadline, and he said, yeah, I did her wrong. You know, that was, I didn't behave properly. And for her, that was the greater betrayal, because she felt that they were, you know, she had come up with a lot of the ideas about the Bloody Bride and had really collaborated with him closely. She didn't think that was just an actress role. And she was felt very betrayed by that.
Maureen Dowd is here. Notorious, portraits of stars from Hollywood culture, fashion, and tech. You write about Tina Fey in the book and how we think of her as just this, you know, perfect, great star. She wasn't always perfect. There was doubt about her ability to be on screen. And the transformative moment was when Sarah Palin was picked to be the vice presidential candidate. And then we couldn't believe what a doppelganger she was for Sarah Palin.
Yeah. I have to say that was one of the most surreal things I ever covered. I kind of pioneered a long time ago working at the intersection of politics and culture. And that was insane. I never thought I'd see anything.
And you said
like
that she really moved the needle on the election.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Will Ferrell has talked about how he worries that his portrayal of George W. Bush had made him so lovable. He was goofy, but lovable, and that helped him win the election. And, you know, Lorne Michaels tries to, he wants to hit both sides, even though his cast is often extremely liberal. And, you know, I was there the night Donald Trump hosted and several years ago, and some of the cast wouldn't talk to him. Some of them were speaking out and saying, this is crazy. And Lorne listens, but Lorne also goes his own way. And when Tina started doing Sarah Palin, it was such a sensation. And then I was following her around the night Sarah Palin. And then later John McCain came on the show. And I think even Lorne Michaels was kind of in a state of shock because it was just crazy.
The voice, the glasses,
everything.
It's amazing. Do you think that Saturday Night Live has the cultural currency or the political currency that it used to?
Well, I just did a big profile on Lorne Michaels. And, you know, really fascinating guy. He's an octogenarian now, but super sharp, super charming guy. And Saturday Night Live is always hit and miss. You know, it just always is.
But Donald Trump got reelected, and they were not doing him any favors.
Right.
He'll get elected a third time, he thinks, despite Saturday Night Live. I'm wondering if they have the punch that they used to. They're still funny. They're really good at making the administration jokes. But does it matter, maybe, that they're doing it?
I think it just goes up and down. I think they can hit with something suddenly. I think the new guy who is doing Donald Trump after Alec Baldwin captures something interesting about Trump, which is his wacky humor. you know, the way he's redecorating the Oval Office and gold leaf and gold Cupids and a gold TV remote.
Wacky humor. I think of it as stream of consciousness. This is a guy who's got his finger on the button and it's a shiny object.
But there's a sort of a Liberace aspect to him where he wants to be the decorator in chief and he wants to be, he runs down to Kennedy Center and he gave this rhapsodic speech about the first time he saw cats. And that the male dancers were in shimmering gold tights, and it was so exciting. Then he goes, but of course, I like the female dancers more. But anyway, my point is that because of this, whatever we want to call it, this Liberace side, it not mitigates, but it counters the authoritarian side. So a lot of Trump's fans don't really think he's doing scary authoritarian things because he's redecorating the Oval Office with gold Cupids.
I say he's drunk with opportunity. Like, hey, I think I'll be in charge of the U.S. soccer team, and I'll be in charge of who performs at the Kennedy Center, and let's rename the Gulf of Mexico. And he's pushing buttons just because he can, and maybe in the process you don't appreciate that he's also got a tariff on cars or something.
Right, right. But also, the first term, and in the decades I've interviewed him, he did not have this acquisitive imperialistic streak. I mean, now he wants to take over Panama. He sent Usha Vance, poor Usha Vance, to Greenland, you know, which they called an aggressive move. He wants to take over.
The Vances were not invited. You know, imagine being sent to Greenland to go to a dog race.
Yeah.
And they don't want you there. I was thinking, Usha must be thinking, what am I doing?
I can't believe they did that
this
to her.
She seems
so lovely. She read the classics on the campaign trail. I wouldn't drag her into all this imperialism.
We're out of time.
Okay, well, that went fast.
Have a real fast, fun time at 5:30 this evening over at Carnival, 702 West Fulton Market in Chicago. The book is called Notorious. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and I've enjoyed your time here in the studio. Thanks for coming
John.
In.
That was so much fun.